Wow. I thought it was going to be hard enough just to follow those good words, and then I have to follow that too. That's certainly more than I signed up for. It's so good to be with you all tonight. I'm so grateful for the invitation to be back with you, and really have looked forward to this time together with you tonight. He mentioned my little children, and that's the bags under my eyes that you see. But today was a really great day in the Darby household. Today was the first day of school, and I can't tell you who was more excited about it, the kids or the parents, because we've needed school to start for a couple weeks now, and it came none too soon. But we're very, very excited for a new season that is upon us and all the different opportunities that this coming season affords. And I appreciate very sincerely the opportunity to be with you tonight. I was told that the topic, the theme of the series is Victory Gardens. And the topic that I was given tonight is the title, Growing is What Victory Gardens Are All About. And I have to admit to you, I knew absolutely nothing about what Victory Gardens even were beyond just the most basic of ideas of what a Victory Garden is. I mean, I knew that it was a wartime effort. I knew that it was an encouragement to people to grow their own crops and to not burden the food supply that was going overseas. But it's been an interesting study for me just to get up to speed a little bit on what exactly the Victory Gardens are. I'm almost hesitant right here. In fact, in my notes, I even have a little asterisk point that said, it would be really curious to ask everybody what kind of things you guys have been talking about this summer, because I find this topic to be so interesting, but I won't take away from our time tonight to feed my own curiosity, although there's a very sincere curiosity that I have. You know, the topic of Victory Gardens and my lack of knowledge really about Victory Gardens sent me down a rabbit hole that took a lot of my time in the last couple of, in the last week and a half. As I was realizing how little I understood and knew about this topic and what it was, and we just live in a crazy good age. I mean, would you agree? It's just a really, really crazy age that I can go into my computer, I can find a Google, bring up Google, and I can type anything in, and just whatever knowledge I could possibly want to know on a topic. It got me thinking. One of my favorite characters of all time is Ben Franklin, and I have had this little mental kind of thought in my mind about a picture that would be so much fun. Because Ben Franklin was such a creative mind, he was such an investigative mind, he was somebody who, he was a polymath. He knew stuff about every subject you could possibly imagine, and he had interests in all kinds of different subjects. And I got to thinking, you know, how cool would it be if I could grab Ben Franklin, I could bring him up to this time, and I could say, look this thing in your hand. Look at this device that you have in your hand. I want you to notice that what all you can do with it. And within a few minutes of playing with it, to show him that he could perform research, that he could do complex mathematical problems, he could translate languages, he could measure distances, he could read classic literature, he could do all this from just a little device that fits in the hand, and I just would love to see him marvel at that. And I think it would absolutely blow his mind. But then the next thing I think would absolutely blow his mind is I can envision him looking at me and saying, so what do you use it for? And I would have to admit that largely I use it for, you know, cat videos and typing to my wife from Kroger, why am I here and what am I supposed to be buying? And when you think about the fact that we have all of this at our resources at our fingertips and how little I really use it for good, it's an embarrassing reality. And I think old Ben would certainly take me to task. But we're talking about Victory Gardens, and we're talking about the journey that I dug into the internet, my rabbit hole as I was researching about Victory Gardens. And so I got to reading several different articles and different accounts. In fact, I read about government programs that encouraged Victory Gardens in Germany, in the United States, and the United Kingdom. And I was especially fascinated by some of the things I saw from the United Kingdom. It was just really, really interesting. It was fantastic how the people of that country so wholeheartedly jumped into this project. Hundreds of thousands of acres that otherwise had been used for anything else or not used for anything at all became farmland. And it was an absolute smashing success there, more so than it was in America, more so than it was in Germany or anywhere else. Those were people that absolutely embraced it. It was fascinating. I was reading about how one of the things that they would do is they would go along the edges of the railroad and they would build these massive gardens that would stretch for miles along the sides of the railway beds. land that's not otherwise used for anything, along the sides of highways, how they took golf courses, which pained me a little bit, but golf courses and made these masterful gardens. They took down these ornate, ornamental gardens that the British are so known for and they love so much, tore it all down and made it into farmland. The thing that was the most interesting was that there was a little movement within this subculture that loved to make gardens out of bomb craters. And whenever they would find a bomb crater, they would repurpose that and they would plant beautiful gardens in it. And it was just an amazing thing to think of something that was a scar, something that was so terrible, something that was bad and evil, but was being used for good, and how they just really had this mindset about that. So there was so much good using unused land in a productive way. The other thing that interested me is that the effect it had on morale. I read stories and accounts and letters of shopkeepers, of school teachers, of railway workers, all kinds of different professions, people who worked in all kinds of different fields, but they kept these gardens. And they talked about how they felt so connected to the effort. They were contributing. They were making a difference. It gave them excitement. It gave them purpose. It gave them meaning. And it meant so much to the people at home. But I found out it was interesting to read about how it was meant so much to the soldiers at war. As they were getting letters from home, and every single person was involved, and everybody was working, and everybody was mobilized, and everybody was contributing, and it gave those soldiers way, way far away this sense that the people back home were engaged, and they loved us, and they supported us, and there was a great morale boost that came from it. The third thing that I found that was really interesting to me was that the Victory Gardens were making a legitimate impact. You know, I honestly kind of had this thought that some of it was sort of a propaganda thing. Some of it was sort of just we got to keep people busy. We got to give them some busy work. We got to give them something so that they'll feel like they're making a difference and contributing in some small way. But the reality is that the research shows it was enormously beneficial. Hundreds of thousands of tons of food that otherwise would have had to feed the people back home was shipped overseas, and it freed it up. It legitimately did gave an impact in the work. Now, at this point, you're like, that's great. That's not why you're here. So will you please get to the point? So here's the point that I'm getting to. The three things that I just mentioned that really impressed me about Victory Gardens form a really solid application for our churches today. Because the same three things that I found so fascinating about Victory Gardens are things that I feel like are really important for us as churches today to hear this. And so I hope this is in keeping with the direction that we were going with this, and I hope this is something that'll be beneficial. But this is what I found, and this is what I thought I would share with you today, how my research on Victory Gardens, something seemingly insignificantly connected to modern-day church, gave me these three talking points. First of all, with the Victory Gardens, they found unused and unwanted, wasted resources and used them productively. They took things that were unused and they put them to work being beneficial. Secondly, they provided a means by which people grew in their productivity. And by growing in their productivity, they grew in their morale, they grew in their enthusiasm, and they grew in their commitment. And third, it really did make a difference in the national effort. It really did change the landscape of the nation and benefit the war effort. If we think about those three things as applications and ideas of ways we can jump into today's talk and give a little perspective for the modern day church, I think we're going to find that those three things are also true in the church today. I think there's a lot of truth in the church today that there's unused resources. I wouldn't say wasted necessarily, but untapped resources. That we have people with potentials and skills and talents. Just a moment ago, I heard an appeal being made for classroom teachers, which is very ironic because Sunday last and Sunday this, I'm going to be standing in front of my congregation and making an appeal for teachers for our upcoming quarters because that seems to be a universal need. There are so many people that we know have gifts and talents and resources that presently aren't able to or aren't choosing to use those in productive ways for the kingdom. Second, there's a great benefit that comes from putting your hand to a good work and working hard at it. Solomon in his wisdom said throughout the course of his book, Ecclesiastes, that there were several things that were really meaningful. Meaningless, meaningless, meaningless. All this stuff he said was meaningless. But if you read the book carefully, there are a few times that he goes, now wait a second, there's some good stuff. Eat, drink, you know, good food, good meal, good wife, hard day's work. He says these are really, really beneficial things. These are great things. These are a gift from God. And you know, when we find ourselves in productive work, we find ourselves contributing to the whole, when we find ourselves making a difference, when we're able to take our resources and our abilities and our talents and put them into play in a way that really benefits the kingdom of God, it is a huge morale boost. And it is something that really dedicates us more fully to the purposes. And third, we're going to find that if we do these things, we really do benefit the kingdom. We really do benefit the kingdom. It's not just simply being busy. It's not just simply, let's go through some motions and let's try to occupy our time until Jesus comes. There's a real legitimate opportunity that's placed before the kingdom of God today, before the church, and an appeal that's being made that Jesus says, I've started a work that I leave you to complete. And that's a real appeal. And we have an opportunity to make a real difference. Let's talk real quickly about these three things, give you some pointers on each one of these, and maybe some practical application of how we can put these into practice in our churches and how we can benefit from an application of this kind of analogy. The unused pieces of land. Unused pieces of land. That was where the productivity came. They looked around, all around the United Kingdom, and they found pieces of land that weren't being used for anything else, and they said, this has potential. This has potential to be beneficial. And when it talks about, when we talk about the idea of applying that to our churches, I was reading an article the other day, not for this lesson, but I was reading an article just with our leadership at church. I'm very blessed not only to be on staff, but to have now for many years served as an elder of that congregation, and I'm grateful for that. And part of our leadership there is reading this article together. And in this article, it talked about 10 people you need in your congregation. 10 people that you need in your congregation. Now, not that you'll have one of these, but 10 types of people, 10 types of abilities and skills that you need. And I'll just go through these quickly, but I found this article to be so helpful. You need a visionary. You need somebody who can say, there's potential of what we can be. We need somebody to cast a vision for us. We need a creative. We need somebody who can think outside the box and bring new and fresh ideas. We need a people person. We need somebody that makes sure everyone feels cared for and loved and that people are treated properly and made to feel that they belong. The reality is, sometimes we disagree, and so we need a negotiator. We need somebody who can sit down between us and resolve conflict and help move us forward. We need a facilitator. Somebody who can organize the work. There's all these projects and needs and all these opportunities. We need somebody who can be in that position to manage that. We need a supporter. And by that specifically, the author was talking about a person who makes it their job to support the workers. Somebody who goes and encourages the workers. Somebody who is that person that writes the notes and says thank you and you're making a difference. We need a person who has a business mind. The reality of the church is that finances play a very important part of it, and we have to manage those well, that we have to steward that properly. This next one's one that we struggle with. You need somebody who's tech savvy, and that's something that we continue to struggle with in my congregation, but that's something you need. Somebody has to make sure that these things turn on when they're supposed to, and that the friends that are sitting in the parking lot are able to hear what we're saying. You need somebody to do that. And lastly, you need a volunteer. You need the people who are actually going to step up and do the work and get it done. You know, when you think about our analogy as it compares to churches today, all those vacant plots that got put to use and had benefit. So what I would do is I would encourage leaders to look around their churches, and I would encourage leaders to say, take a list like this and look around and see the people that you have in those roles. See the people that you identify. That person's a visionary. That person's a creative. That person's a volunteer. And first thing I would suggest is go talk to them and tell them how much you appreciate them. Go and make sure they know how much value they bring to the congregation. And then second, I would say, where are the holes? Where are the people you don't have? Where are the needs that you presently have? And to use another farming analogy, Jesus in Luke chapter 10 looks at a situation that is very unique. And he says, ask the Father to send workers for this specific need. In this case, it was harvesters, send workers into the field. But whatever the need is, for leaders to sit down together and to say, God, please send us some people who can fill this role. Help us to find those people. Because I think that's exactly in keeping with Jesus' teaching. When he says send harvesters, he sees a need and he's asking God to send somebody to fill the need. And I think that's exactly what we're doing when we make it, when we have a prayer like that. The other side of that coin, I think of the parable of the talents. And I think about the parable of the talents, which we all know very well. And a man was given a single talent and he went and hid it in the ground and he never used it. It didn't provide any benefit. It didn't provide any kingdom work. It doesn't provide anything that made a difference. And unfortunately, we need to look closely at ourselves to see if we ever do that. Has God given us a talent that we don't put into work, we don't put into effort? I love the passage that Paul writes to the Ephesian church in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 9. He says, "We are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." We'll look at this verse again in a moment, but for right here, I just want us to say that this is a God who had a purpose for us, and He equipped us for that purpose. He gave us what we would need for the task that He put before us. That shows an enormous amount of planning and prescriptive thought that God has put into that. And if God has a purpose for us, and God gave us a talent for that purpose, and He gave us the opportunity to fulfill that purpose, doesn't it make sense that He would expect us to use it for the kingdom? When Paul talks about the kingdom as a body, the church as a body, there's an eye and there's an ear and there's a foot and a toe and a finger and all the other things that go into it. And the bottom line of it all is that we need all of those things, and no toe is going to make up for a finger. We can't be all that we can be if all the parts aren't pulling together and if everything isn't working in concert together. I really love an old hymn that we don't sing very often anymore. But there's an old hymn, "Rise Up, O Men of God," that has a line in it that's been bouncing around in my head this week as I've been working on this talk. There's a line that says, "Her," meaning the church, "her strength unequaled to her task, rise up and make her great." It's a really cool image when you think about it. A piece of unused land along the side of a road that becomes a beautiful garden. A bomb crater that becomes a beautiful garden. A piece of field that's not used for anything that becomes profitable. And I think that we need to look around our own plot of land and see, is there an unused resource that the kingdom needs to employ, that I need to employ for the kingdom? I think we would benefit the church if we would give an accounting of ourselves and determine if there is something that we can be doing. That was the first thing about Victory Gardens that stood out to me. The second was the boost to morale. The boost to morale. And I got to say, this was very unexpected for me. I wouldn't have guessed that this would be the case. But when I thought about this idea of the boost to morale that comes, I thought of another farming illustration. And this is James, the brother of Jesus, the half-brother of Jesus. And he talks in James 5 and verse 7 about some important qualities that farmers bring. Now, never been a farmer. In fact, I joke that I have three houseplants, any one of which is at the point of death at any moment. That's the extent of my gardening expertise, is trying hard to keep three houseplants alive. My three little boys came home the other day, each with a Venus flytrap. So now the grand total of plants in my house are six. And those little Venus flytraps do not have a chance, because so far all I've seen them do with it is take pencils and just poke the little prods and make them squeeze. And that seems to be the only thing they want to do with it. And I'll say, "Have you watered it?" And they'll go, "No, but I've poked it like 347 times. So if it is like mussels, then these things are going to be like the most, muscle-bound Venus flytraps in the world, but they're never going to have water. In 5:7 of James, the idea of this farmer is that the farmer plants and then he waits. And he watches and he waits. And he watches and he waits. But there's an air of confidence. There's a hopefulness. There's an optimism to this. This isn't a "I'm going to throw it in the ground and just hope." This isn't an "I'm going to throw it in the ground and maybe it'll get lucky." It's a throw it in the ground and be confident that there's going to be something good that comes out of this. And there is something to be learned from the patience and the confidence that a farmer has when he plants his seed. And there's a boost to our morale when we can grab and take to heart the lesson of a patient, confident farmer. In recent years, Maybe you haven't experienced this, maybe you have, but our church and many other churches have experienced smaller numbers. We've seen reduced numbers in recent years, and there's been several reasons. I think obviously the pandemic has a big part to do with that. We still have a good number of people who are not coming back yet because of health concerns, and we feel that. And in times like this, it's really easy to be pessimistic. It's really easy to be down. It's really easy for me to stand in front of the auditorium and to see the people in my mind that aren't there instead of seeing the people that are there. And I don't embody that kind of patient, optimistic confidence that a farmer has. And I need to learn that lesson. And I may not be the only one that needs to learn that lesson. Paul told the Corinthian church that he planted and Apollos watered. But you remember how it finishes? God gave the increase. You see, what's fascinating about that is Paul says, I know what my job is and I did my job. My job, Paul says, is not to give increase. That's not my job. I can't do that. What I can do is I can faithfully plant. Apollos, his job was not to plant the seed. It had been planted. His job was not to give the increase. He can't do that. But what he can do is he can water. He can do what he can do. He can be responsible for that which is within his control. He can do what is possible for him to do. And we can all resolutely trust in God to do what only God can do. And that's where I think we, in leadership of the churches, need to really be careful about becoming so overly pessimistic about the situation and circumstances that we are. These trying times need to redirect us in leadership to an idea that we are responsible for what we have the capacity to do. And what we have the capacity to do is to faithfully sow the seed. And that is what we're called to do, and God will do what only God can do, and that's bring about the fruit. And you know what I think? I think that leads to better morale. I think that leads to more hopefulness. I think that leads to more optimism. I think that gives preachers and teachers and leaders and elders an opportunity to see things through a different lens. And so much of what I saw with the Victory Gardens was an opportunity through hard work for people to see their circumstances through a different lens. They needed it then. And I think the church needs it now. There's a second idea that came to me as I was thinking about morale, as I was thinking about the enthusiasm, the excitement, the dedication, the commitment, the fervor of God's people. And it revolves around this idea. And bear with me, because this is kind of a silly idea, I know, but I think it really has value. It's my belief that whenever a created thing performs its created purpose, it glorifies the one who created it. I'll say it again. I believe that every time a created thing fulfills its created purpose, it glorifies the one who created it. It may sound weird to say it, but I think every day that the sun travels across the sky, the sun glorifies God. Why? Because that's what God made the sun to do. And when God made the sun to do that, and the sun does what he made it to do, he's glorified. He's glorified by his creation doing what he sent it to do. When the rain falls, that's what God created it to do, and he's glorified by that. When a blade of grass pushes out from the ground, that's what God created it to do, which, by the way, my yard is not glorifying God terribly right now. New puppy and three little boys is not helping the glory of God in my grass. But that's what it does. A bird that flies, a fish that swims, a cricket that hops, an orange leaf on an oak tree. These glorify God because that's what he created them to do. So stop. What did he create us to do? What did he create us to do? We just read it, his handiwork. Doesn't it make sense that by being his handiwork, we've already established he has a purpose for us, and when we perform that purpose, we give him glory because that's what he created us to do? Is there anything you can think of that's more morale boosting than knowing that you're bringing joy to God? Knowing that you are bringing glory to God? Now, we're not going to do it perfectly. In fact, we're going to do it in terribly flawed ways. We're all train wrecks, and we know that. But the point I'm making is, as we fervently pursue the purpose for which we were created, it's giving glory to God. And I think that's an enormous morale booster that our churches need to hear today. I think they need to hear. I think we need to hear. I think I need to hear personally that as we pursue those things which God has put before us to do, we are bringing glory to him. And I think we'll find a great deal of enthusiasm that comes from that. You know, Victory Gardens really did enthuse the morale of the British soldier and the British commoner alike. But I can't imagine that holds a candle to the kind of enthusiasm that we can find from putting the shoulder to the work God gives us and knowing that He's pleased with our efforts. I think those are really important lessons. And those have been lessons that have been impactful to me. But there's a third topic. A third topic. And that is the question of whether or not the Victory Gardens really did any good. Were they just a photo opportunity? Were they just a means by which that people could feel like they were doing something, but it just really was a sleight of hand and a silly, worthless activity that meant nothing? No, I don't think so. They had a real impact. When they took those unused resources and caused them to be productive, when they allowed themselves to enjoy the benefit of a morale that comes from genuine hard work that contributes to a meaningful cause and makes a difference, and they felt that satisfaction, and it motivated them to work even harder, I think it did real benefit. One way that I think we can apply that, one way I think that that can benefit us today, is that as we recognize these truths and we apply these truths towards the church, we'll find that we're going to be workers that are more capable, more dedicated, more devoted, more joyful. That we're going to be more interested in and engaged with the work that the church is doing. And it's going to equip us to work harder, to work longer, and to work with more satisfaction, because we recognize who it is that we're serving and the good that we're trying to be about. Paul in Galatians chapter 6 has several verses there, maybe through 4 or 5 down through 13. There's a section there that has sort of an agricultural illustration. And there are several good points in that particular passage, but the thing that jumped out to me this week is that he talks about we should not grow weary in doing good. Here in the midst of this illustration about farming, he says, don't grow weary in doing good. Well, I think there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, from what little I understand about farming, it's hard work. It's a lot of hard work. And when you're not working hard, you're waiting, and waiting is hard work. So everything about the whole process of farming seems to be a lot of hard work, either physically or emotionally, either the sweat of my back or the strain of my mind. There's a lot of hard work. And Paul uses this illustration to be the time to say, don't grow weary in doing good. It's curious to me that we never tell people not to do something that's not possible. You don't have to tell me, Jeff, don't dunk this basketball on that goal. You don't have to tell me that, because it's not possible. I can't do it. I'm not going to be able to do that. But Paul says, don't grow weary in doing good, which means the inference has to be true, that one can grow weary in doing good. And not only that, he wouldn't warn us against it if not only was it possible to happen, if it were not likely to happen. It is likely to happen. It is natural to happen. Growing weary in doing good is a natural thing. It's going to happen. We're going to find ourselves in situations where it becomes wearisome. It becomes heavy. It becomes tiresome. And that's the thing that Paul is saying. He speaks into that moment and he says, don't allow that to happen. Don't allow it to happen that you grow weary in doing good. Be encouraged, be committed, be connected, continue to do the good. Don't grow weary in doing good. What is it that we're doing? What is the good that we're to be about? What is it that Paul's worried we're going to be discouraged from continuing to do? Well, I think all of the ways that we answer that are related to what our skills, abilities, talents are, and where God has placed us, where His handiwork. And He's put us in the moment that He's put us in for the purpose that He's given us. And He's telling us it can become wearisome. Don't fall victim to discouragement. Discouragement, I think, is one of the great enemies of the church today. I think it's very easy to become discouraged. I don't know where everybody is, and I won't project my own personal demons on you, but I will say that I have found in recent months, in fact, in the last 2 years, that my consumption of news has gone just so far down. my discussions with other people, my conversations, my postings on Facebook and discussions that I used to be very much associated with and a part of, I've just had to step away from so much of that because I found it so discouraging. I found it so discouraging. It felt heavy and dark, and it was just continual bad news and discouragement. In my own silly little mind, I've started to recognize a voice, a familiar voice. Not literally, I'm not crazy. I'm just saying, figuratively, a voice of discouragement that comes and whispers in my head a lot. Why are you bothering? Why are you continuing? Is that really going to do any good? Is it really going to make a difference? Is anybody really listening? Is there anything to this? Are you sure this is the right choice? I'm not confident that that's a good decision. Constant discouragement. And one of the things that I'm trying to do more and more is to be prayerful and ask God to point out that voice, because I know who that voice is. That's not God's voice. That's not the Spirit's prompting. That's Satan discouraging. And that's why we have to be careful not to grow weary. Because Satan is very dedicated in tiring us out. What would make Satan happier than to see God's handiwork not doing God's purpose? What would make Satan happier than God not being glorified by his church? That's the happiest he can be. And he knows the way he can do it is to discourage. So why is it that I think this analogy of putting your effort into unused resources and allowing yourself to feel the satisfaction of working hard, I think one benefit of it is that we inoculate ourselves from the discouraging voice of Satan in our head. And I think it helps to keep us safe from growing weary. And that's how we can make a real impact in the kingdom. I wasn't going to share this, but an illustration that it was actually Greg Tidwell. Some of you may know Greg Tidwell. One time at camp gave this illustration. It was just a beautiful illustration. We came to the campfire there, and off to the side he had a bench set up that nobody was sitting on. He had a tall candle and a short candle and had them both lit. It was dark, of course, and so you could just see the two flames. And he would say, you know, to a kid, which one of those would you rather use to get yourself back to the cabin tonight? Well, it doesn't matter. They're both the same amount of light. Which one would you rather use if you had to, you know, read a book in your cabin tonight? Well, it doesn't matter. It's the same amount of light. Then he said, which one would you rather have if you knew it was the only light you had for the rest of the week? And everybody's like, the big candle, because it's going to last the longer. That's important. Satan wants to shorten our candles. Satan wants to do anything he can to shorten our candles. And discouragement burns out our candles. If it doesn't flat, put it out. And I think we need to be careful. I think we need to be careful of that. One last thought on that subject. Making a real benefit for the war effort. And it's this, a little piece from Psalm 104. You, God, you cause grass to grow and plants for man to cultivate that he may bring food from the earth. Let's read that again. You, God, cause grass to grow and plants, listen, for man to cultivate, that he, man, may bring food from the earth. That is bizarre. That is really interesting. What it says here is that God does a thing and then invites us to join him in doing the thing and then puts the success of the thing on our joint effort. That was a lot. Let me say it again. God does a thing, and then he invites us to join him in the thing, and then hangs the success of the thing on our joint effort. Look at what it says here. God causes the grass to grow and the plants to grow. Why? So that man can make food from it. Can God not make a whole lot better food than we could? Absolutely he could. But you see, that's part of how God operates. He wants our participation. He could give us four-course meals that would rival anything that we could ever possibly imagine with no effort whatsoever, but that's not his point. His point is he wants to give us the resources so that we then can join with him in the effort of providing something that's beautiful and productive. That's exactly what he does with the church. God condescends to invite man to join God in what God is already doing. And I think there's something really important about us recognizing our place in that. I have an 8, 9, and 12-year-old, and a 25 and a 27-year-old. Those two don't help me with anything anymore, but the other three sometimes help me with chores. The other day we had to put a new gate up on a fence, and I won't tell you how the fence broke, but I have an 8, a 9, and a 12-year-old, so you can guess how the fence broke. But we were putting up a new gate, and it was a all-day Saturday project to put up a gate that I honestly believe in about 14 minutes I could have put up by myself. I could have done it a whole lot faster, a whole lot easier, and with a whole lot less frustration if we're all involved. But that wasn't the point. Because them working with me was a big part of the whole purpose. God does that. That's exactly what God does. God makes a church, a thing we couldn't do. Then he makes us part of the church, thing that we can't do. And then he tells his church to go save the world, a thing we can only do with his help. God does a thing. He invites us to join him in the thing. And then he hangs the success on our joint effort. The reason this little thought came to me when I was reading about a Victory Garden is that, like my young sons and our household projects, God is very interested not only in accomplishing the purpose, but God is very interested in the relationship that he's building with us. That's why I want my boys to help me work on the car. Not because they're great at working on the car, but because I want us to be great in our relationship. God is so devoted. He would that none would be lost, but that all would come to repentance. And he's chosen us to partner with him to do that. So back to my point. The Victory Gardens had profound impact on the war effort. They really made a difference. And you know what? If the church is going to be what the church can be, we're going to have to really make a difference in the war effort. It's an honor. It's an honor to be a part of a kingdom that God has called to such a high task. And it's something that we ought to be enthusiastic about. It's something we ought to be fully invested in. It's something we ought to be engaged with all that we have. And we all ought to put into hearts those pictures, those ideas, those thoughts that say, what is it that I've been given by God for the purpose of contributing to the work of the church and making a difference in kingdom work? And you know what? Even though I do it clumsily, and even though I do it stumbling and bumbling and fumbling in all the ways that I use, every time I attempt to use my gifts and you attempt to use your gifts, we bring glory to God, joy to a Father's heart. And we join in with him on the greatest task, the greatest mission, the most important thing, the thing that brought Jesus Christ down from heaven to live on this earth, adding to the population of heaven on that final day. That is something worth getting excited about. I learned a lot about Victory Gardens, and it was a lot of fun reading about all that. But I walked away with a lot more understanding about how I should live as a Christian and what God expects of me in the joint effort that we have together, of which I'm honored and you're honored to be a part. So, I hope that out of this there was something that was helpful to you, because it was certainly enjoyable and beneficial to me. Thanks so much for having me back. I really do appreciate the opportunity. I'll give it back to you.